one. I'll skip the usual introduction. So make sure to check the links in the description and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Very important. And today, this week, we'll talk about the unwritten rules for success in machine learning and many other things. And we have a special guest today, Jack. Jack transitioned from software engineering to data science, and he worked in both as both individual contributor and in leadership roles. So he managed at some point up to 15 people, and currently he is the VP of Data Science and Machine Learning. And soon, there's even a date, you gave us a date, November 15th, he plans to move to become an entrepreneur. So yeah, welcome to our podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Alexi. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
The questions for today's interview are, as always, prepared by Johanna Bayer. Thanks, Johanna, for your help. And let's start. So before we go into our main topic of these unwritten rules, let's start with your background. Can you tell us about your career journey so far?
Yeah. So I started out my professional career in 2015 as a full-stack software developer. I was working at a company called Trunk Club. They're sort of like Stitch Fix. They're owned by Nordstrom Online Retail. And started out as a software developer, worked there for a couple of years in that role, but then became interested in data science and machine learning and made a transition within the company to a data scientist role.
Do you remember what made you interested in data science?
Yeah. So actually, I had sort of always been interested in data science, going back to my undergrad days when I was a physics major and took a lot of stats classes. But you know, this was 10 years ago. So at the time, data science was not well established. And there was no master's degree, there was no bachelor's degree, there was no clear career path. So I decided to do software engineering, a master's in software engineering, intending to go into data science. But I ended up just really enjoying software engineering, so I stuck with it for a couple of years. And then at some point, though, I started to become interested in machine learning again. And a data science team was spun up at my company. You know, I watched what they were doing and became very interested in it. And so I made the transition into that team through an apprenticeship program that was...
So there was an internal opportunity.
Yeah, it was not easy. It was, you know, I had to be very assertive and ask a lot of times, and then eventually landed a informal apprenticeship opportunity within that where I was like doing a side project. But was able to switch, did data science at Trunk Club for a year, and then moved on to a company called GoHealth, which is sort of like Orbitz or Kayak, but for health insurance.
It's Orbitz or Kayak.
Yeah.
Orbitz, I think, wait. I think like I was in the States at some point and I needed to buy a ticket, airplane ticket. And this is what you use for comparing prices, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. It's like a Skyscanner.
Yes. So think about that for health insurance. You know, at least in the United States, most of us get health insurance through our employer. And you have like three plans to choose from. But for people who are not employed or people who are, you know, self-employed, to choose a health insurance plan, you know, it's complicated. So this platform was basically like the selection process for that. Mm-hmm. In any case, so I was a senior machine learning engineer there, started out in that role. The data team was also new at GoHealth. And quickly, I found myself informally managing that team because, you know, there was a data science team within GoHealth and the data organization itself was maybe 15 to 20 people all being managed by one person. And so naturally, you know, people stepped up as informal managers and that was me for the data scientist and the data analysts around me. So I was formally promoted to manager after a year or two. And then I was promoted to director after another year or two after that. Most of that was around having successful projects launched. So after a big project launch, you know, that would generate a bunch of excitement and demonstrate value to the company, leadership would want to invest in more data science and machine learning, and naturally that would come to me.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, in retrospect, do you think it was a bit too fast, too quick? Because like you worked for a few years as an individual contributor and then like, boom, you became a manager. Like, what was it like for you?
It's a really good question.
Like now when you look back, was it too quick or was it like just the right pace?
It's a good question. I'll give you two short answers to that. The first one I'll say is that because I did a lateral move between software engineering and data science and machine learning, there's so much overlap between those skill sets and like professional maturity that I would say...
I assume it helped a lot, right?
It did, yeah. So it wasn't like I had just 1 year of experience before managing. It was more like I had like four before being promoted because there's, again, there's just so much overlap between the two. So I would say that. The other part though, I would say is that being promoted to manager, it's almost always like it feels too soon and it will always feel too soon because there just is a shift that is very difficult to emulate a seamless transition. Like it's a new paradigm, it's a new thing to experience and it is always going to be a difficult transition. That being said, sure, it was fairly fast and you know both good and bad results came from that.
Mm-hmm. But you also learned a lot, I assume, right?
Oh yeah.
Because like when you move fast, you also learn fast, right? Because like you have no choice.
Exactly, yeah. So that was, you know, when I think about like the pivotal years of my professional career, there were two sort of time periods. The first was just my first couple of years at Trunk Club, being in part of a strong technology organization, develop a lot of really good fundamentals and you sort of like get into your groove. And then the next phase was going from a senior IC role to director within a couple of years. That was just, you know, very different from the other part, but learned a lot. That's where you learn a lot of things that like are not really taught anywhere. It's very difficult to teach them because
there is no school for VPs of data science, right? So you just have to like, yeah, how do you actually learn these skills?
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was trial and error. It was realizing what worked and what didn't work.
How do you even know what worked? Like,
yeah, a lot of that is what I'll share, you know, in general is just like what works, what doesn't work, why does it work? And, you know, in fact, that's a lot of the reasons why I started to be more proactive on social media. But yeah, that was a great learning period for me. You know, you learn a lot of lessons around being able to convince people of value, you know, knowing when and how to articulate accuracy versus something that may be less precise, but more compelling, things like that. You know, a lot of being a leader is you have to, in some sense, be a salesperson to the rest of the business where you have to be able to demonstrate value. You have to sell value. You have to translate, you know, why is this needed? Trying to convince a non-technical stakeholder why you have to spend a month on cleaning up tech debt. You need some sales skills to do that well. So there's just a lot of things that are very, you know, it's difficult to teach those in any kind of technical curriculum because they're so opposite of what needs to be emphasized early on in that career.
Did you have free engineering background, engineering education, like software engineering?
Yeah. So my master's degree was in software engineering. Mm-hmm. And then my first couple of years were software engineering.
So I assume it's not a skill you picked up during studies, right? So like during software engineering classes.
No.
You are not taught like how to sell things. You learn how to, I don't know, do Java and algorithms and all that stuff, databases, right? So you're not learning how to sell things. So how did, like it was all trial and error, right? So you just see like how you approach a person and you try to kind of sell a project or something. And then you see, you feel what works, what doesn't, right?
Yeah, I would say it's a mix of trial and error. And it's also a mix of observing what works for others. So, you know, another thing that is not really taught very often in any kind of school environment is the importance of technical problem framing and understanding the business and user side of the applications you're building. One story I like to tell is when I was a young software developer, you know, a couple of years into my career, I felt like I was really strong technically. And then I would look around myself at like the people on my team and think, okay, who's better at what? How do I make myself better? And then I would look to my tech lead and see, okay, what makes them special? And something I observed was that my tech lead at the time was strong technically, definitely more stronger than I was because they were more experienced. But relative to the people around him, he was not necessarily that much stronger. But there was a clear difference in how much he could produce and the value that he provided. And the difference was that he was really, really good at taking the time to understand deeply the applications that we were building and, you know, taking our 2 hour meetings with stakeholders to ask them questions and really just understand the aspects of the product as well as anyone else did at the business. Because once he understood that, he could then come back to the tech team and be able to translate, okay, here's what we need to do. Here's what we need to prioritize. Here's why this is the way that it is. And that is something that's very difficult to teach. you know, it's difficult to teach because when you're learning software development, you're so overwhelmed by everything else that hearing someone try to explain that is like, well, that's obvious. You know, I can focus about that later. So it's very difficult to sort of like mentally allocate the right capacity to something like that when you're getting crushed by all of this very difficult technical stuff. So that's sort of something that, you know, even on LinkedIn when I post, if I post something about that, the amount of interest that I'll get relative to posting something very technical is so much lower, right? Because most people don't feel like they're struggling with that right now. They feel like they're struggling with the technical parts. And so that is the more valuable piece to them. And so these other parts that really do help differentiate people in their careers often go unnoticed and are not learned until trial and error several years later.
So like one of these things that go unnoticed, as you mentioned, is understanding the applications, right, on the deep level, and understanding what generates value, right? That's one of the things, as you mentioned, this tech lead had that other, maybe less senior people did not. Are there other things like these hidden things that are not obvious when you study, when you like focus on technical things, but that are actually very important at work?
Yeah. So one thing that's extremely important is people's perception of you. Another thing that is never taught in any course that I've ever seen is in order to be successful in any, especially in leadership, but really in any role, people have to respect your opinion. And, you know, when you ask for things, they give them to you. Like that is just an essential part of being a high impact, either IC or manager. And in order to do that well, people have to respect your opinion. And developing a reputation for respect and, you know, strong consideration is something that is difficult and is something that I learned just over time how to do. You know, one simple tip that I give to people is anytime you're given an opportunity to do a presentation in front of an audience, spend way, way more time on that than you think you should. Like anytime you have an opportunity to speak to people that you don't normally speak to, their perspective of you very heavily on that discussion or that presentation, because that's really their only perspective into you, is that's their only interaction with you. And so, you know, if you're giving a presentation to leadership or even just other teams, if those teams aren't working with you directly frequently, they don't know how good you are. They don't know any of that. And so you really have to make sure that anytime you're given an opportunity to interact with others who you don't interact with on a day-to-day basis, you have to take advantage of that. And that's where like the sales stuff comes into play, where, you know, maybe saying things as they are is not always the best thing. You want to sell them, you want to promote them. And really what you should be thinking about is like, what is the ultimate action that I want to be taking? So, you know, if you're thinking about the month of technical debt cleanup, you know, if you try and explain the exact reason why that's so important, you probably won't get what you need. And so you need to be able to communicate it in another way. And you need to be able to put on a persona that is well respected so that you get what you want. So that's another aspect that is just like, you know, it's more of a quote unquote softer skill, but it's critical to success. You know, some people can get to the top through just technical skills, but they're very few and far between. Most people who get to the top are doing so through non-technical means.
So look for opportunities to speak in front of people who you don't interact with regularly. And when you get this opportunity, invest a lot of time in preparing the presentation that you give, right?
Yes.
And probably like you should avoid technical things, like in your example of technical debt. Like you shouldn't say like, I don't know, we need to refactor a lot of code because like our classes are too long, right? Like you should probably come up with a good metaphor, right? Instead of explaining like the code, like you probably find it relatable idea from the real world and then explain based on that, right?
Yeah. And even extending that, something that I like to do is to think through what people care about. You know, so if you're working professionally and you have, let's say you're interfacing with like marketing will obsess over things like CAC, cost per acquisition. You know, all they care about is conversion and CAC and things like that. So if you're trying to present to them something like, you know, related to machine learning or data science or whatever it is, if you can talk to them in terms of, you know, impact to CAC or something that you know that they will care about. Mm-hmm. So it's the amount of money that marketing needs to spend in order to acquire a customer on average. Mm-hmm. So it's like their primary KPI or key metric.
So like when you speak with the marketing people, you need to learn their vocabulary, right? So you need to say like to use words like this cost per acquisition and so on, right? Cost per customer. I already forgot. And so then they can already relate to what you're talking about, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And once you start using that terminology or vocabulary, now they feel like you understand them and will start to have more respect for you. Because what often happens is, you know, technology people speak technology, marketing people speak marketing, and both sides feel like the other doesn't understand what they think is important and therefore does not understand anything important. And so you kind of talk past each other a lot. But if you're able to speak it their language, you're able to get their respect. And now they'll actually start to listen to you more seriously because they feel like you know what matters to them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We will see how relevant it is. I hope it is relevant to the actual discussion we plan to have today, which is like the rules for success in machine learning. Probably it is related. I just want to summarize, like, if you want to be like a technical leader, there are some qualities that are good to have, like understanding the application. And then the important thing is people's perception of you. So you need to gain respect from them. And for that, you need to appear in front of other people and speak their language. So use their terminology, and then you kind of become biased, or like they treat you as one of their own, right? So and this way you get respect. So these things that we discussed, they're pretty interesting to discuss, like how related they are to successful machine learning projects?
Very well intertwined. So especially with machine learning, you know, any kind of project, but specifically machine learning, one of the challenges with machine learning is just how complex it is and how much support you need from every part of the business for machine learning to work. You know, any software developer will tell you like getting support for a new project is difficult, and that's absolutely true. But the level of support that you need to execute a machine learning project that actually works and provides value is, you know, I'm going to pull out a number here, but maybe 3x what a typical software project does. And that's because there's so much level of care that needs to be involved with generating data, transforming it, setting up that pipeline, building the model, building the prediction pipeline. There's just so many things that can go wrong and so much effort that needs to be taken that in order to allocate the resources for that, you have to have a lot of motivation and a lot of buy-in from stakeholders. So being able to sell is a very crucial skill of pretty much any machine learning person, because in order to gain enough support for your projects, you have to be able to get people excited about the potential of what you're going to build. And so that's something that I learned, you know, maybe a year or two into my career in machine learning, was that a lot of the projects I wanted to build were dead in the water because I couldn't get enough support. So what I started to do was to figure out the ways in order to generate excitement and get that support that I needed. One example is being able to get to a proof of concept that I can use in a demo very quickly to show on like a real sample data set, like a prediction in real time. That is very effective at getting interest between people because they can see like the potential value of it. But going back to your question, so like how do these skills intertwine with successful machine learning, or, you know, the rules of machine learning? You have to understand that like machine learning, you don't just get handed machine learning projects and your only task is to execute on it. That does not happen. A huge part of your role in machine learning is to be able to communicate back value to buy yourself, you know, the bandwidth and the resources that you're going to need in the future. That's a very often overlooked aspect.
So you mentioned that these machine learning projects are quite complex, and then they require 3x, like arbitrary number, but they require a lot more effort than a traditional usual software engineering project. Not to mention that these projects often fail, right? So, because you don't know in advance whether the project will succeed after you put so much effort in them. Like, how do you sell that? Like, by doing this POC and showing it kind of sort of works, or?
Yeah, so there's a couple things going for you with machine learning that you can leverage to your benefit. Right now, it's actually, this is the best time ever for this because large language models have generated excitement across the entire planet. So in this moment, it is much easier to sell people on machine learning than it was 4 or 5 years ago.
Because like there is this hype everywhere in like open any website and you see GPT, LLM, whatever.
It's a double-edged sword where there's benefits to that and negatives to that. Mm-hmm. However, even so, it is still difficult to sell projects because, like you said, there is so much risk involved. A lot of what people really like, what the connection that people make with machine learning is they want to automate their decision-making or what they think is possible with decision-making. So a lot of people, you can play off of that. So, you know, for example, if you wanted to build a model that was prioritizing incoming inbound leads for your, you know, your sales process, there are people at your company who are, they spend their days trying to think through, how do we ensure that we're properly handling like the highest quality leads, the people who are actually going to buy and spend a lot of money? Like, how do we ensure that they're treated well? Well, if you can build a model that, you know, if you can showcase a simple model that says we can detect which leads are going to be high value, that is like very, very easy for people to realize the potential impact or use for that. And if you can give them even just a little bit of evidence that you're capable of building that, that then they'll buy into that. So really, you want to like play to what they care about and then give them some evidence of that and showcase it. Like, visuals are very, really good selling points here. If you can give them that, you're much more likely to get that buy-in. And if you have stakeholder, you know, support, you can typically get the engineering resources, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. By visuals. So you said visuals are important to them. What do you mean by that? Like, is it is having a demo with user interface where they can play is important, or you meant something else? Or like having a picture, planting a picture in their head or something else?
Yeah, so it's a good question. Let me make another comparison using like the domain from a different company I worked for. So I worked for Wayfair a couple of years ago, and using this context, just because it's easy to understand, furniture.
They sell furniture, right?
Yeah. The model that I'm going to describe, I didn't build, but here's a hypothetical model, and here's how two ways that you could pitch it. And one would be effective and one would not be. So let's say you wanted to build a model that could detect someone's preferences for like styles of furniture. So let's say that it's, you know, like I like rustic furniture, farmhouse or something like that, whereas maybe you like modern furniture or something. And let's say that I built a proof of concept model and wanted to pitch this. I could show people, you know, the accuracy of items bought that were related to the style of furniture that I said they were. So, you know, somebody purchases a couch, with 70% probability, I can predict which type of style it is based off of my model. That is not a good way to sell your model. A better way to sell your model is to go and show three examples of, you know, stylistic preferences that a customer has, and then they purchased in the past, and then show them the next three items that they might purchase in the future because they have similar styles. So this is a good way to visualize it too.
Mm-hmm. So you pick a customer, a random customer, and say, okay, this is person X, and this is what they like, this kind of furniture they like, right? So these are their preferences.
Right.
And based on that, we think that the next three orders will be these things.
Right. And what that does is it gives your audience, your stakeholders, it shows them like loosely how the model is thinking about things. So, you know, maybe the two different couches are the same material or something. And they can start to mentally wrap their head around, oh, here's what the model is, how it's able to think. And then they can take that and they can generalize that to all these other things that they care about, where it would be useful to have an automated decision-making process that could detect that. So really, you're trying to get them to understand the model and what it can do, and then let them take that notion and like run using their own, you know, internal knowledge, communicating things in like an accuracy where at the end of the day, those are the things that matter, but they're not great for selling because that's not how your stakeholders are thinking about things.
Again, if you start talking about accuracy, right, and they say like, okay, this model is 70% accurate, which like may or may not be a good number depending on the model, right? But like to the stakeholders, it might sound scary, like 30% error rate, like 30% of times it will make mistakes. Like, oh, how bad? Like, how do you handle that? Not speaking about that or?
Yeah, so it's a good question. And, you know, actually of the two problems, that is the easier problem, is trying to communicate error rates and things like that. So typically what I like to do actually is not communicate accuracy, because it is the easiest one to pick apart and say, like, this is not good enough. What I try and do is discuss precision and recall.
Which, like, they're quite technical, right? Like, you need to give very good illustrations to people.
Yeah.
Because, like, even for data scientists, I remember studying machine learning at university. Like, I was always lost at precision and recall. Like, for me, it was super confusing. Like, I always confused the two. Like, it took me some time to actually feel comfortable with these two metrics.
Yeah. So I don't actually use the words precision or recall, but what I am discussing is precision recall. And what I say is I'll show, like, for example, a sliding bar of how specific do you want, or how much of a threshold do you want to draw between overguessing or underguessing? Mm-hmm. And so typically I'll use precision and recall and then discuss. And the goal is not necessarily to give them exact numbers, but it's to inform them that there is, we can control the trade-off that we're making. And it gives them more, like, they're more comfortable with that because it means, oh, well, if we're over-predicting, we can just, you know, take that slider back. And they remember the slider. They remember that there is a threshold, and it gives them more comfort to know that they're in control.
Do you use something like Streamlit or Gradio for that? Or you use your full stack development skills and, like, build the React app?
No. I do whatever I can generate in the shortest amount of time that looks decent is what I do.
Which is, like, usually Gradio or something like that, right?
Yeah, sometimes. A lot of the times, it depends. It depends on the organization. You know, if I had more time, I'll do something like that. Honestly, sometimes I'll just go into Google Sheets and set up something that's very, very, very basic.
I see. Yeah, interesting. Well, we still wanted to talk about the rules of machine learning and the unwritten ones. And there is this famous article from Google, which is called The Rules of Machine Learning, right? You probably know about that. And I remember, like, the rule number one is don't be afraid to start without machine learning. That's my favorite one. Like, and it's kind of funny because, like, you're a data scientist or machine learning engineer. Like, how can you advocate for not using machine learning? Like, it's a bit counterintuitive, right? And then, like, they talk about metrics and so on. So this is definitely a really good article to talk about. But since today we talk about the unwritten rules, so I'm wondering what these rules are.
Yeah, awesome question. There's a lot of them. So I think, actually, let me touch on what you just mentioned really quick, because I think it's so, regardless of if it's written or not written, I think it's, maybe let me expand on that because of the importance of that, which is often not written. So I completely agree with that statement that it is critical to, and I would even go beyond saying, don't be afraid to start. And I would say, always try to start without machine learning. And the reason for that is because the most frequent reason that I see machine learning projects fail is because whatever you end up building doesn't actually solve any problems. So even if you build an accurate machine learning model, that does not necessarily mean that whatever it's doing is going to provide value to the business. And so ensuring that before you build machine learning, ensuring that whatever problem you're solving is actually worth solving with or without machine learning, that should always be the first focus. So, you know, I always emphasize you should do a proof of concept, heuristic, like rule-based model first. Forget machine learning, forget all the complexities with that. Try to just spin up a manual process or a rule-based process that emulates what a machine learning model is going to do, but does so at a much more basic level. And honestly, 9 times out of 10, if you can't make that work, the machine learning model is also not going to work.
So I have a story about that.
Yeah.
So, like, a few years ago, so we wanted to launch a model for predicting the quality of pictures. Like, if a picture has a good quality, like, it was an online classified. So were there people would sell and buy cars. So one idea was that to make listings more attractive, we can look at listings with bad quality pictures. And if there are bad pictures, we contact the sellers and ask them to improve the picture, which is, like, probably a reasonable assumption that if they improve, then probably more people will become interested in that. And then we started building the model, a deep learning one, of course, because it's images, right? And then, like, a few months after, we were finally ready to test it. Turned out that nobody really cared. Like, the thing that people mostly care about when looking at listings is price, right? Not quality of images. And, like, the sellers, they aren't really super reactive to these suggestions. So what could have happened instead is, like, I just sit down, take a sample of images and say, this image is good, this image is bad. We sent a an email to the seller saying, okay, your image is bad, like, do something about this and see how many people react. One day of work, right? And then like, okay, nobody cares about that. So let's just, you know, put this idea aside for some time and focus on something else.
Yeah.
I love this story. It was like, it's something I experienced myself, right? And then like one thing is somebody, when somebody says like, you just nod and say, yeah. But like having experienced this firsthand is like totally different thing.
Exactly. That is exactly like the type of situation that occurs. And again, it also is evident in software engineering where a lot of people ask for things, you know, 10 years ago or whatever, the common thing was, can you build me an app that does this? That was the question everyone wanted was, I have an idea for an app. And, you know, I need a feature that does this. And eventually you realize that you have to start vetting who is asking that question, why they're asking it, because oftentimes people think they want something and then in reality, they don't even use it. So it's basically like the same problem as that, but much more intense because machine learning is so much more difficult and expensive, both in terms of actual monetary costs and development time, that making a mistake here is much more costly than in just a typical software development project, usually. So it's definitely very critical. So I wanted to highlight that point because, you know, when you think about like the unwritten rules of machine learning is that you really have to understand that the human nature of getting lost in the technical details in machine learning projects, that all of us, even experienced people, have a tendency to get lost in what we're building and then lose sight of the actual goal. And when we do that, you are almost guaranteed to fail. So, you know, the unwritten rule here is not necessarily like starting with ML or not using ML. It's more about understanding that end goal and then really iterating on ways of improving that. And as a natural consequence, your first attempt should not use machine learning. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and then you establish a baseline. Well, you first prove like if this idea is valuable at all, then you can establish baseline and then you can iterate on top of that and you can always see like if this is actually an improvement over the previous iteration.
Exactly. So another concrete example of this with machine learning was at one point in my career, I built a customer churn model. So, you know, in any subscription-based company, churn is when they cancel their subscription. And for the company in question, I won't mention which one it is, just to keep things somewhat private, is we try to build a churn prediction model, and I did. And it actually was pretty accurate. It could detect who was going to churn. The problem with that was there was nothing we could do about it. Like we thought that there was going to be something we could do when we were able to identify someone who was about to churn. But in this case, there was really like, there was no action to take that was likely going to make them not churn. And so because of that, the whole model was useless, right? Like it didn't provide any value. And the reason for that is because it wasn't actionable. And had we gone through like a more, you know, heuristic-based approach, we would have saved ourselves several months of development time.
Was it the case? Because when you try to approach people and prevent them from not churning, they are annoyed even more? Or
no, so I would guess that is often the case. In this case, it wasn't. And it was more so, it was because of like the reason that they were churning was not because they were unhappy, but because of external factors that were driving them to churn. Again, I don't want to get too into it.
Like then you would give away the company,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But like in the hypothetical situation, like let's say there is a telecom provider and people are churning because like there is a different provider with better prices and you cannot lower your prices.
Exactly. That's a very good example.
Like if you lower, then you kind of work like you don't generate enough revenue.
Right. Your margins would be off. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so the first unwritten rule. I'm wondering, so in this podcast, we have transcripts, right? So like after this is transcribed, this rule becomes written.
Yeah. Most of this stuff I'm already posting on LinkedIn anyway. So I guess at this point it is written.
It's too late. Like the commonly unwritten rules by what Jack has written about them, right? Okay. So the first rule is like we'll get caught up in technical details and we don't see. So we lose sight of the end goal and then like we just get too interested to invest it in details, like tuning this, because it's exciting to tune all these knobs of a deep learning model, for example, or any machine learning model. Anyway, so that's one thing. So we need to focus on the end goal. And sometimes it means like doing things manually, right?
Exactly. The next one. So here's another unwritten rule. And that is, well, let me describe a more common written rule, and let me describe what I think the unwritten version should be. So the commonly told rule is you should be obsessing over data and obsessing over understanding the patterns and the distribution and nuances to it. And I agree. However, I think that that is somewhat misleading. And I think a better way of phrasing it is that you need to understand not only the data, but you need to understand the process or the things that the data represents. That is really what you should be obsessing over. So for example, if you are looking at customer buying patterns for an online retail company, you need to understand who your audience is. You need to understand how they like to buy. It's even better if you yourself are a customer. You need to really understand, like, what is it that is producing this data that I'm looking at from every angle, because it's very easy to, again, lose sight of like what's actually happening when you're just focusing on numbers and data. All of this makes way more sense, and all of the directions you go with your analysis are much easier to do if you focus first on just completely understanding the real world process that data represents. So a quote that I've started saying more recently is, you need to recognize that data is a shadow of reality, not reality itself, because data is just an artifact being produced by something. And so inherently, it is always going to be an imperfect representation of something else. And if you have access to understanding that real representation or whatever it is, you should focus on that, because the data will never tell you everything. It will only be a shadow of what you're actually trying to understand. And so if you can understand, you know, customer buying patterns because you yourself are a customer, if it's, you know, understanding the output of a machine in a machine shop, you should be able to, you know, deeply understand what the machine is, all of its parts, why it's doing what it's doing. If you can do that, all of the data will start to make sense. And, you know, one example of where I see people trip up with this is that people will find nuances or patterns or significant things in data that are actually just not real, and they're just anomalies with how the data is being produced. And, you know, people will think, oh, I just found this new, you know, hidden reason for why a customer churns, when in reality, it's just sort of like because the process for logging the data is biased in some way. So 9 times out of 10, if you observe some anomaly in data, it's probably not a real world anomaly. It's probably just something to do with either the way the data was stored or your perspective of the data.
So you need to have this domain knowledge. Like, let's say if you work at Wayfair or like some other store that sells furniture, you need to understand the domain, like all this, let's say, customer journey from like the moment they sign up to the moment they receive furniture happily, like hopefully like in time, right? So like you need to understand all this journey and like all the problems that can happen on the journey from like the first step till the last step. And the best way of getting this domain knowledge is being a customer yourself, right? Like if you work at a company that sells furniture, go ahead and use that website to order some furniture for yourself.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, like I've always, once I realized this, I started looking for jobs only where I was a customer, because I realized how important it was to put myself in the shoes of the people I was building stuff for. So I really wanted to be able to identify with the customers. You know, my first job was at Trump Club, but that was only a year in data science machine learning. When I was at GoHealth, most of our customers were Medicare recipients, which is people who are 65 and older in the US. So I couldn't really identify with them. So I always found that part difficult. But when I went to Wayfair, it was very easy because I was already a Wayfair customer. I already purchased furniture. We had just bought a house. So like I was buying furniture all the time. And so it was just like very relevant.
Is this the house where you live now?
Yeah, this is the house.
Is the chair from Wayfair?
Actually, no. In fact, my office is actually, most of it is not Wayfair, but a lot of the rest of the house is Wayfair. Yeah. And then the same thing with Fi, my current company. So we make smart dog collars. And I think my dog is probably somewhere in my office, but like a collar that they wear around their neck.
Like a leash of sorts.
Yeah, so it's more of like a Fitbit or a GPS tracker. So if your dog escapes, you can track them. Uh-huh. But we also do stuff like, you know, step counts and movement and behavior tracking and things like that.
Uh-huh. Like fitness trackers, but for dogs.
Exactly. And so, you know, you have an app where you can see, okay, I got this many steps today, or, you know, I took my dog for 10 miles of walks the past week. That's 5 miles less than what it was the week before. So for people who are dog owners, it's like, and interested in like fitness or data tracking, it's like, it's a fun thing. And, you know, dogs and data tracking and health tracking are all things that I'm interested in. So to me, it was like, oh, this is a product that I am very interested in. It will be very natural for me to put myself in the shoes of a customer because I am one, essentially.
And like if you had a cat, had you had a cat, not a dog, then for you, it would be more difficult to relate, right?
It would be, actually.
You would have to like get a dog.
And you know what's funny is a lot of people who come to Fi do end up getting a dog.
Well, that's not bad, right?
No, it's great.
Okay, so the second rule is understand how the data is generated. And the quote you gave was, realize that the data is actually only the shadow of reality. So you need to remember that and and make sure you understand the process, and then the data will make more sense and you will be able to understand that the patterns you find, they're not actually like real patterns, but more like anomalies. And if you don't have this domain knowledge, you will not be able to understand that.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay.
So another unwritten rule that I've written about many times is that there's a lot of emphasis when teaching machine learning on mathematics and algorithms and things like that, which are absolutely essential. However, one thing that I think is often under-addressed is that to be successful in machine learning or to be high impact, you really need software development skills. At the end of the day, machine learning is software. It is a specific type of software. But when you build machine learning, you are building software and it is likely going to go into a production state. And so being not just familiar, but like actually, you know, intermediate to advanced in software development skills is critical to being successful in machine learning. You know, this is maybe, I would say, sometimes a hot topic that I'll have where not everyone agrees with me. But what I can tell you is that in, you know, the 6 years that I've been in machine learning, almost everyone who's been successful in machine learning has been successful largely due to their skills in software development, or that they will spend the time to get good at them. Because it's very difficult to have success when you are only able to address one part of the machine learning funnel and you have to hand off everything else, because it requires that everyone, that you be in a position where there are others who are extremely competent and can work with you to take, you know, hand off a model in a Jupyter notebook and hand it off and then deploy it. There's a lot of stuff involved there. And to be reliant on others to do that well is very limiting in terms of your own success. And it also means that it's difficult to put you on projects where there are limited resources. You know, I can't give somebody a project if I know that, like, you know, a full stack ML project, if I know that I don't have enough MLOps resources, which is especially true in smaller companies.
So you need to be some sort of full stack data science machine learning person, ideally, right? And then, like, if you can do that, then you can take a project end to end. Like, you don't need to be an expert in all the areas, but just to know enough, like, to take the notebook and put it as a web service.
Yeah, and I want to make a careful distinction that, because a lot of times what people think that I'm saying is that you don't need to know machine learning that well, which isn't true. You do need to know machine learning. You also need to know software engineering or software development. So I would say it's more so that, like, there is a strong balance. And typically the emphasis is on learning the machine learning side, you know, again, because it's so difficult and it's very overwhelming that even understanding that part is so, takes up all of your mental bandwidth, that thinking about software development too is just seems unnecessary. When in reality, it is very important to understand, you know, can you take a piece of code and put it into a web server on AWS? You know, if you can do that and you can do it comfortably, you're in a really good spot to be able to deploy machine learning models and be a full stack ML developer.
Yeah. So what we teach in our courses, what we say in our courses, like, your model can be like super good, but if nobody can use it, if it's just in Jupyter notebook, then it's not good. Like, it's of no use. So you need to be able to do that. And all these unwritten rules were already written, as you said, somewhere, probably your LinkedIn. You probably published them on LinkedIn. So can you tell us more about, like, where can people find this content that you, like, all these things we talked about?
Yeah. So as of right now, it's all on LinkedIn, and I write one post every day. I post it every day at 6:15 a.m. Central Time. And for the ones that I think are really good and informative to people, I leave them.
You wake up soon.
Yeah, well, I write it the day before, and then I schedule it to be posted at 6:15. But then I'm up at, I'm actually up at 6 to respond to people's comments.
Okay.
But I leave them in my featured section on LinkedIn. At some point, maybe I'll consider doing a newsletter. I know that's commonly what people do. At the moment, though, you know, I'm still sort of writing on LinkedIn. A few months ago, I started in like late July. It was the first time I ever posted on LinkedIn. So I'm still, like, you know, I, even just now, I'm sort of figuring out what I want to say and how I want to say it. So at the moment, that's where it is. But if you follow me there, you know, you'll stay in touch with some other places that I'll be putting this data.
And a good idea is, like, in LinkedIn, you can click on this ring icon, not ring, like, bell icon. And then, like, the moment you do this, you'll get notified about the posts. Because the problem with LinkedIn is, like, you need to rely on the algorithm to make sure that next time I open it, I see your post. While in newsletter, you don't have this problem, right? It's
right.
Like, you actually deliver, and then it's up to me to decide, like, do I have time to read it down? Or I'll have time to read it later, so you're not at...
That's actually a good point. And I actually hadn't thought about that, but that is a very good point. Yeah.
I think you should start a newsletter, because, like, for me, like, if I really want to make sure I do not miss your content, like, I'd rather subscribe to a newsletter rather than rely on the algorithm to constantly show it to me.
Yeah.
Because they might decide that, okay, let's show more ads, and then I see you.
Actually, that's a very good point. I hadn't thought about that. So maybe I'll consider that now.
Yeah. What happens on November 15th?
On November 15th, that will be my last day at my company, Fi. So I am leaving to start a new business in machine learning, data science, and more generally data recruiting. So there's an idea that I've been thinking through the last couple of years. I've known I wanted to do this, and I think now is a good time, which is, I think we are in a spot where we need a big shift in how technology hiring is done. I'm very unhappy for many reasons with the current state of hiring. Both from an employer perspective and a candidate perspective, I think there is so much noise in the system that it is very subjective who is considered for a role. People don't feel like they have any control over where they get considered for a role. I don't think people are interviewing for all the things that actually matter in success. You know, I think through all the things I discussed today in terms of what drives success, how many of those things are actually interviewed for well in technology interviews? Very few. So I have done hiring differently, you know, throughout my career. I've approached it in ways that I think make sense. And, you know, you can take a look at the teams that I've built over the last 5-6 years, and they speak for themselves in terms of how strong they are. And so what I want to do is take this and give it to other employers and other companies is, hey, here's a different way of thinking about hiring where you can actually have a much clearer picture around what success looks like. And for candidates to be able to give them more control of, you know, let's think through what are your strengths? How do we best showcase them? Rather than, you know, putting you through arbitrary quizzes and questions that may not actually well align with your strengths. So I'm going to start a business that is in technology hiring and recruiting. And it's going to focus in the short term on machine learning and data science and maybe some other data roles. But in general, I would like to extend it to any technology role. And the idea is to be able to give people more ability to articulate on the candidate side what their strengths are and showcase that, make that available than just a traditional resume. And on the employer side, be able to both understand what it is that they need to succeed and be able to find that quickly instead of having to do, you know, many hours of interviewing on their own.
So we will all subscribe, follow you on LinkedIn, and we will see all the updates about your new endeavor. So I don't like saying good luck because you probably don't need luck. You more need, like, perseverance, but luck also is important. So have fun with your new project. And thanks a lot for coming, joining us today, sharing all your experience, all these unwritten rules, and thanks everyone too. I unfortunately have to run, but it was great pleasure talking with you. And yeah, have a great rest of your week.
Likewise. Thanks, Alexi.